Bold. Brave. Herb. With Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode 508 of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Today, I'm joined by Dr. Rita McGrath, the queen of pivoting. Can I say that, Rita?
It's one of the things I'm known for, absolutely.
So, Rita, you've written so much about this. You have such an incredible background, a longtime professor at the Columbia Business School. Hats off to the Columbia Business School. One of the world's top experts on strategy, innovation, and then this marvelous book, Seeing Around Corners, How to Spot Inflection Points in Business Before They Happen. So we're talking about a woman's life. So let's start right on in. What the heck is this whole issue about pivot?
Well, a pivot is what happens when you set down, call it an entrepreneurial or an innovation path, and something happens that you didn't expect that causes you to have to change your direction. And humans are fascinating. You know, when we think about doing something, a project, an innovation, something that's new, doing something for ourselves, it's new, doing something personal. We have this mental model. We sort of are going to start at point A, and we're going to have this smooth glide path to point B, then we're going to arrive at point B, and we're there, right? It never works like that. Nothing works like that, you know, in life.
You
know, in real life, there's always going to be bumps in the road or things you didn't expect, or somebody doesn't do what they said they were going to do, or, you know, the world changes, or there's an executive order, for heaven's sake, and you have to redirect what you're doing to adjust.
I can think of maybe countless times in a woman's life when this takes place, you know, as she goes through her decision-making, the endless decision-making from the moment she wakes up until she collapses at nighttime. So when you talk about pivot points in your book and in all your work, you also have another phrase, the inflection point. Define that, and then how does that relate to pivot point?
So an inflection point I define as something that creates a 10x or more shift in what's possible. So it allows you to go 10 times faster, 10 times cheaper. Maybe with AI, it's 10 times smarter, you know, but it changes the constraints that you're operating under. So if you think about it, back in my dad's day, you know, if you wanted to send a memo in an office to someone, it was a memo. It came on a piece of paper. There was a thing on top that said, please retain, may be discarded. And someone physically had to take that thing, like from floor to floor to floor in the office. And this, you know, I'm not 1,000 years old. I mean, this is relatively recent history. And that's all completely changed. So if you think about women, right, that work of carrying memos around and setting up meetings and keeping the wheels turning, that used to be work that an awful lot of women did. Secretaries, remember that title? Administrative assistants. And today, we've completely changed. We're doing all that work ourselves, for good or for ill. Leaders, managers, middle managers are responsible for their own communication. But it's a completely different speed, way of operating, a change to the constraint. So that's what I'm talking about. It's something that just shifts what's possible by an order of 10 or greater.
How do you define an inflection point then in personal life? Give us some examples.
Oh, sure. Well, the most significant, of course, to me, the number one would be who you marry or who you partner up with. I mean, I can't think of a more consequential life choice that a woman can make. And it's definitely an inflection. You know, if your partner is not the right person, or if you can't could have helped each other grow forward, that can be a disaster. If your partner is supportive and gets behind you and you can approach things as a team, that's awesome. And that's the thing about inflection points, you know, in personal life. If you get it wrong, it can really be a disaster. If you get it right, it can really open up whole new vectors of growth. So getting married would certainly be one, going off to college if you're in that mode, or taking your first job. I mean, these are all decisions that could down the road prove to be highly consequential. We just sometimes don't even know it at the time.
Isn't that interesting? I think that most people are unaware of this. They're kind of muddling through, shall I say that nicely. I'm thinking of something it's an interesting memory that came to mind as you were speaking. And that was when my parents sat me down for my first adult decision. And that was which high school I was going to go to. Now, it was very interesting because I was in San Francisco. I was finishing up all the Saints, St. Brendan, St. Cecilia. We were kind of doing that, going down that road. The good news is I had phenomenal, you know, English lit and all the rest of it, because those Dominican nuns do not screw around. But I was also aware of the fact that they usually hit a ceiling in their own training in math and science. And somewhere along the line, I knew I loved math and science. So they sat me down. This was an inflection point. And they said, which high school would you like to go to? Here are the following options. Miss Burke's School for Girls. Okay, I'm a tomboy. That would last about, I don't know, 10 nanoseconds. You know, I'd be falling out of a tree somewhere. I've been a lifelong athlete, tomboy. And I'm like, no, I don't think we're doing the white glove thing. So that was like a big X. Now we were left with St. Rose. That was the one for girls. St. Ignatius for boys. Or, drum roll, Lowell. Now, Lowell is one of the top public schools in the country. It's like a Bronx Psi. So you get in with the highest GPAs. They didn't care if you were, you know, from another planet, whatever. We did have those people in my class. However, it was all about GPA. They had more advanced placement classes than they had regular classes. And they were extremely good with science and math. So I'm like, all right, let's do that. So we kind of pitched the Saints to the curb and we pushed on with Lowell. And to this day, it was one of the smartest decisions of my life. Because to your point, and I'm trying to exemplify this with a real life situation, it opened up countless doors, because coming from Lowell, you know, kind of conferred its own thing. I immediately got into Berkeley and, you know, all the rest of it is pre-med and this and that. So I could have chosen St. Rose and I don't know where I'd end up. Now that I think about it, it kind of horrifies me. But that being said, that was a beautiful thing. Now, what's a warning sign that the inflection point maybe passing you by? Are there ways, you know, because I know that most of the women in the Her podcast audience are going, but how do I know? You know, like I lucked out. I kind of put a little thought into it. I was just a kid and somehow I made the right decision. But are there warning signs that maybe this may or may not work? What?
Well, I think anytime you're faced with, you know, a choice which is really going to take you on a divergent path, that's a decision you want to take more consciously and proactively than if it's a choice that's easily reversible, right? So I'll just give a flip example. You know, let's say I decided I wanted to dye my hair red. I've always thought that would be really fun. Well, you know, I could do that. And if it doesn't work out, give it a few months and it, you know, I'll be back to where I was. So that's not a life-changing decision. But there are other decisions which are not so easily reversible. So the first question I would ask myself is, if I make this choice and I'm not happy with where I end up on the other end of it, can I just walk back through the door, right? Or if I make a choice, something consequential, like who you marry, where you go to college, where you go to high school, who you invite to your home, who are you with in the carpool? You know, those are sort of irreversible or very hard to reverse choices, or they're very expensive, or they have big implications. That's a signal to me that you're really staring at a possible personal inflection point.
That's really interesting. I never thought about that in, you know, deeply. And that is, you know, can I get out of this mess? Right?
Right. Yeah. And by the way, you don't have to spend as much time mulling it over if it's a reversible decision, right? At that point, go with the thing that seems easiest or most logical at the time. Don't overthink it. Just move forward. If it's a really heavy duty decision you need to think through, something I use a lot is a decision sort of worksheet. And you sort of frame the problem that you're facing in the middle of the worksheet. And you say, what's the best way to, I'll make this up, what's the best way to make sure my kids are in a good school district? And your best decision is only as good as your best option. So the first things I really encourage people to do is generate as many options as you can, because very often what happens with human beings is we pose ourselves a problem and then we leap immediately to what the first viable thing is. We don't really say, well, what are my best choices? Because the best choice you can make is only as good as your best option. So to go back to school district, right? Well, I could move into a nice suburban school district, which has access to it. But there are other choices, right? I could think about charter schools. I could think about homeschooling. I could think about, you know, there's a lot of different arrays. And I'm not saying that one is necessarily better than the other, but you want to generate this list of options. And you also want to be mindful of the constraints, right? So yes, I'd love to move into a suburban school district, but I live in California and I can't afford it. So that kind of is a constraint I have to deal with. Now that maybe there's creative ways around it. But what I think you want to do with those irreversible decisions is put some thought into kind of getting your ideas down on a piece of paper. Then you can kind of work around it. So you can say, are there constraints I can release? Are there more options I can generate? What are the key assumptions that I'm making? And you kind of work around the decision that way.
One of the things we know in science is that women tend to be much more anxious than men. You're nodding, going, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a keen grasp of the obvious. Since we both are ovarian members of our crazy sisterhood. So what I've observed, and also this has been backed by science, is that women don't just worry, we pre-worry. We worry about not worrying enough. And we just turn this into a royal mess. And I've watched women go back and forth, back and forth, you know, with self-doubt, you know, is this the right decision, or back and forth. I'm laughing because when I did my Myers-Briggs, which I'm sure we've all done, look at that one column on decision-making. I didn't have a single self-doubt check. All my score was in the acid decision-making. I mean, I see it, I do it, let's move it along. Right? I'm just one of those people. Every now and then I have something I've got to overmull, but, you know, so there you have it. Now, my question to you as the expert is there a real gender specificity to how this works? This whole pivoting and identifying and working with inflection points. Do women, and I'm doing this for my wonderful audience out there, do women overthink things relative to men? I'm just wondering.
They do. They absolutely do. So there's three things maybe I would mention with respect to gender difference in how you make decisions. So I think the first thing that women do to themselves is, let's say there's a list of job requirements, right? If you're going to go for a new job or a new role. Women, if there's 10 things on the list, they're like, I've only got 9. I couldn't possibly try for that. They don't even try, right? They cut themselves off before they've even raised their hand and said, you know, men, they got like one thing on the list or nothing on the list, but they're like, hey, I got this. I can learn how to do this, right? So there's a confidence that comes from, in many cases, you know, men are on this much easier glide path, right? So they're like, I got this, right? So men tend to be, relative to women, overconfident. Women tend to underplay their confidence. A wonderful sort of role model of mine is Sharon Price John, who's the CEO of Build-A-Bear Workshop. She's still wonderful. And she was speaking at Columbia recently, and she said, you know, the only thing on a checklist of items that prepares you to be a CEO is having already been a CEO.
I just okay, thought that was well, sacred. That's a small problem there,
right?
And that is you
right?
Had to have dug through the tunnels of the first CEO experience
exactly.
And learned like hell, right?
Right. So that's the first thing. Women tend not to be confident in that they're capable of doing what they actually are capable of doing. Second thing, and this is definitely gendered, which is in any group setting, whatever the group is that has less power, and in many cases it's women, they have what's called a narrower range of acceptable behavior. And we've all been there, right? So, you know, if you're polite and pleasant, you're a lightweight, right? But if you're, you know, ambitious and hard charging, oh, you know, you're aggressive or even worse. It's interesting. There was a job done of anonymized resumes submitted by, no, sorry, anonymized performance evaluations submitted for both men and women. And the researchers took out the names and then went through and had a computer analyze the results of these performance evaluations. And there was a word that kept showing up in the women's evaluations that did not show up on a single man's evaluation. And it was something like aggressive. You know, it was just, So these women, you know, women who are aggressive, are forward looking, get branded with this kind of, oh, she's, you know, she's not a pleasant person. So you kind of have to figure out your own recipe for working your way through that, because holding back and not going for it for you is not the best option. Even though, you know, people might put you in this low power position, it's much smarter if you come up with your own strategies for doing that. But you have to be pretty conscious of that, because it's not conscious in many cases, this low power double bind. Oh, abrasive was the word, not aggressive. Abrasive, you know, high power women who are exhibiting high power abrasive never turns up in a man's evaluation. Never, not once.
Abrasive, that's me.
Abrasive. I just saying, you know.
Busted.
And then I think the third thing that happens to women in these decision situations is we don't take up the space, right? We do things like, oh, I'm sorry. Did I speak too soon? Did I pick too quick? I mean, it's like, get over it. Stop saying you're sorry. Sorry about what? You know, do you hear men running around talking about how sorry they are that they had the temerity to be in this space? No. So I think women can help themselves get better about that and get a buddy. Practice. You got a big job interview coming up. Practice. Have it recorded. You know, play it with AI. I mean, however you kind of get yourself comfortable to be confident without being obnoxious, you know, that you can do this thing. And women have this, a friend of mine calls it the itty bitty shitty committee in your head.
Oh, wait a minute. I got to write that down. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Isn't that a great phrase?
The itty bitty shitty committee?
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. That's excellent.
Yeah. Isn't that great?
That is just fabulous in your head.
Yeah, in your head. And it's, they're there all the time with all this negative talk, right? Oh, you're not good enough. You couldn't do that. Why would you think that? You know, just blah, blah, blah. You could put those guys on pause. You could fire them. You know, you could tell them at this particular moment, your advice is not serving me well. So there are things you can do.
Like, you have to go now, right?
Like,
you know what I really, you know, when you were talking about that, you know, I'm sorry now. I'm sorry. Okay. That makes me crazy. It drives me crazy. And it's a short drive. All right. Men don't say that. They don't go, I'm sorry. You know, no, I don't hear that. And women say it for the wildest things. It's like nothing burgers. And you're saying, I'm sorry. The time that it really hit me home and I became much more aggressive about telling women to stop doing that is, I'm not kidding you. So as a triathlete, I'm out there on the water. Now, come on, athletes are a hardy little individual. Okay, we're abrasive. We're out there and we're just like slugging it out, honey, because we want to get to that finish line and hopefully even medal. Who knows? So you're out there, right? So I'm swimming. And anyone who's ever swam in a triathlon, it is crazy. I mean, people, the bodies are going by and ankles are going in your face. And, you know, it's kind of a wild time, right? And I'm not kidding. I'm out there. In this case, it was an all-women's triathlon. And every time someone kind of got a little too close to me or maybe just accidentally hit my arm or something, I usually try to stay out of the fray. But every now and then people, you know, I literally in the water, I would hear a woman yell out, sorry, like, what? We're in the middle of a triathlon. Why are you apologizing? I mean, I'm expecting to get slapped in the head with your foot, you know, and here, I'm going to do it right back to you. You know, I'll be abrasive. I was like, that's when it really hit home. If you're doing that in the middle of a triathlon, what are you doing at work? What are you doing everywhere else? That's crazy. So I usually very gently and nicely, it kills me, but gently and nicely, I say, you know, don't apologize. Unless it's obvious, you know, you just spill some coffee on someone. It's like, whoops, sorry about that, you know. But all the rest of it, no, you're fine. You're just fine. There's no need to apologize for your existence. And that's sort of a reflection, I think, of just not feeling worthy. And there you have it. So, all right, now we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to ask you about the four stages of the inflection points. The Her Podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And we're back. Okay. So, four stages of the inflection points. Go for it.
Well, this would be in business. It's a little different in the personal situation.
We'll nuance it a little bit.
So in business, what happens is there's this, you know, huge amount of hype originally when the inflection point first becomes obvious to everybody. So it's November of 2022 and we have ChatGPT and now the world is all about AI and everything's going to be different forever and ever starting right now. So, you know, what happens? Everybody gets in on the hype. I think ChatGPT got like 10 million users in a matter of a couple of weeks. Everybody's trying it. Everybody's talking about it. And so it's all very exciting because now we've seen this possibility. It's sparked our imagination. But the early stages of anything are not complete. So what ends up happening is all this money, all this time, all this excitement happens. And then there's sort of this disillusionment phase. And people sort of say, oh, well, you know, that AI stuff, that's never going to amount to anything. You even hear people talking about it right now. They're saying, AI, you know, it's totally overhyped. It's never going to actually deliver the business value that we think it will, blah, 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 blah. But out of that phase, that sort of middle phase where a lot of people are starting to dismiss the technology, what you begin to see is some real business models, some real demonstrations, proof of concept. And those first few pioneers sort of show the way, then you have a stage where more people are kind of being very practical about it. So you can almost think about it as going from a casino to now we're going into something that actually has, you know, legs and we can use it. And then it becomes just taken granted as part of our life. So if you think about the internet, just as an example, in the mid-90s, there was all this, oh my God, the internet, you know, and it was a terrible time to be an entrepreneurship professor, I have to tell you, because these kids were getting like $1 million in VC money just because they came up with the phrase business model. And then we had the crash and everybody said, oh, that internet thing's never going to amount to anything. But out of the crash, we had eBay, we had Amazon, you know, we had companies that were building communication. We had the first ever fast broadband, the stuff like that. And then that created the infrastructure, which we could then build on. And today, few of us could imagine living our lives completely without the internet, right? So it becomes just taken for granted as part of the world.
So I'm coming up with a woman's version of these beautiful inflection stages. Ozempic.
There you go.
See, now you can use this. Look, I'm doing you totally a favor here. You there can you use go this in your next talk. So there you see, let's talk about personal life for a minute instead of just business. Okay. So out of the blue, we have the GLP-1s. As everyone knows by now, are the obesity medications that are currently injectable. Overnight, just like you said, for AI, everything changed. It was a game changer. There's no question about it. And, you know, people are buying it for cash and celebrities who have 3 pounds to drop are injecting it daily. And just like,
oh, it's crazy.
Everyone's all in. It's like, this is it. The world has changed. Go.
Right. Before you go there, though, so that all happened, I'm going to say 2021-ish, sort of, that year.
Ish.
But here's the interesting thing about inflection points. And this is where, as a strategist, it started to get some traction for me because I've been playing around with this idea for years. But if an inflection point comes out of nowhere and you didn't see it coming, what good does it do you to be a strategist in that world? So here's the interesting thing. Most big inflection points, when the thing happens, right? That's when the hype gets triggered. That's when everybody knows about it now. And for Ozempic and drugs like it, that would be 2021. But here's the thing, those drugs were in clinical trials and people knew about the weight loss effects as early as 2017. In fact, even earlier, you probably are aware of this, doctors were actually prescribing it kind of off-label.
It was over 30 years ago that the first GLP-1 appeared, right, and that was for fairly severe type 2 diabetes.
Right.
No one said a word.
Nope.
There was no excitement. It was like, another drug, you know, inject it, you're a mess, and that's it.
But what happened in 2021 was Hollywood discovered it, right?
That's correct. That's why I said the celebrities.
Yeah, yeah. So you had the Ozempic Oscars, you had, and that's when I think it broke through, you know, went through that tipping point into the greater population.
That's a brilliant point. It really is, because a lot of people, once they learned that the original GLP-1 is over 30 years old, might be 35, something like that, big deal, nothing burger.
Right.
But,
right,
you know, when all of a sudden you notice Oprah's finally, you know, dropped a boatload of, you know, weight, and you're like, okay, what's up? You know, right, what are we doing here? And then a lot of other people doing the same thing. You've got anchors on television who suddenly look a heck of a lot smaller, and just a lot of public figures. There's politicians who've done whatever. All of a sudden, it's in the public domain. It's a thing. So I think that that figured into the inflection point on the GLP-1s. I think that that really fed and fueled a lot of what happened there. And then the question, just to your point, you said it so beautifully in the stages. All of a sudden, you know, we're like, oh, excited and it's all good and everything. And then all of a sudden we start hearing about the side effects. These aren't, you know, come on now, I'm a doctor. You know, where there's an action, there's a consequence. And none of these medications come without side effects. And in some people, they're pretty rough. And then as the months went on, we discovered more and more and more. Things started getting complex. Then we saw the rebound, gained it all back, you know, when I couldn't afford to the $1,000 a month. And then we had the compounding pharmacies popping up. I was just watching this whole thing take place and looking at people's decision-making as they went through all this. The Wall Street Journal actually had a great article, you might have read it, from one of their own people. I think he's in San Francisco or on the West Coast. He was somebody who used Mounjaro, I believe, for a while, dropped about 40 pounds, 30, 40 pounds, did really well on it, and then started breaking out in a sweat. Like, now what do I do? What he outlined beautifully in this Wall Street Journal article that came out about a week and a half ago was everything he had to do to keep the party going. So he stopped the medication. That his first mistake was he didn't wean himself. So he just sort of overnighted it. Somebody needed to have informed him. Number two, up the exercise. No more of this, you know, I think I'll take a walk today. No, you won't. You're actually going to schedule in a lot of exercise. Two, you're going to clean up your eating. A lot of people who inject this stuff are eating the same stuff. It's just less of it. And they need to clean it up. And believe it or not, he dropped another 20 pounds on his own. Bless him. And he looks phenomenal. And he just says, I'm different now. I'm completely different. I live a different life. No, it's not always a party. And what I love just looking at that, well, look at all the inflection points he had, because he had to make that decision. He made a decision. To your point, which I can't get out of my mind now, it's so perfect. It's like, well, if I screw it up, I can exit. All right. So he could always go back on Mounjaro if things got a little funkadelic there. So I love the way you've laid all of this out so well, for women to kind of see that you have choices in life, countless choices, that women tend to overthink them. Women tend to overthink them. They beat a lot of these decision-making processes to death and then don't get off first base. I'm advocating for being a little more decisive and strategic, and then do like what you said, Rita, which is, if it's something you can get yourself out of, that's cool. Way I love to look at it is, if I, you know, make the wrong decision and I fall on my little behind, stand up, dust it off, move it along, girlfriend. learn, you know, life's full of these life lessons. And I just look at it that way. What did you learn? What can you apply to the next decision-making process? I think I harp on a lot of this because I just see women sometimes tied up in knots with decision-making. And I see guys, to your point, you know, basically over-appreciating their decisiveness. That's a PC way of saying, you know what. So it's interesting. As you've followed women in their careers, that CEO that you mentioned, for instance, and others, they learn from the mistakes they make.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
But are they risk averse, or are they willing to take on some risk to be able to learn the life lesson?
Well, I think broadly, the stereotype is women are more risk averse. And I think that has roots, you know, in biology. I mean, as we evolved, if, you know, if mom made some sort of tragic miscalculation, the whole family could suffer. So I think there's a level of caution that's probably bred into our brains. I would say that the women who are successful, who have broken through that, have the ability to really say, well, is this really risky? So my friend Sharon that I mentioned before, she has a rubric that she uses. She says when she's facing a difficult decision, for example, do I want to ask for a promotion? And she says, well, what's the worst
that
can happen?
That's a big one.
Right? What's the worst that can happen? And if you ask yourself, well, what's the worst that can happen if I ask a promotion? The worst that'll happen is they'll say no. And then you have the opportunity to say, well, why not? And then they have the, you know, you'll get information, right? So you don't have enough international experience. We're really looking for someone who's got big brand background. We need somebody who's more numerate, right? Whatever the feedback is, you wouldn't get that feedback if you didn't ask. And now they know you're interested, right? So I've got a great example of this. I was doing a massive program for a company called Genentech, which is out in California, the original gene therapy company. And we were developing it to help some of their high potentials sort of accelerate their careers. And at the opening cocktail party, one of the women who is a bright young marketer had really done a lot of amazing things, happened to meet someone from the senior committee, the senior leadership team, and their chief marketing officer role was coming open. And she, in this casual social setting, she said, you know, that might be a role that I would really aspire to. I would really love to be a chief marketing officer someday. Before that, she wasn't on the list. They hadn't considered her. They didn't think of her, not because she wasn't totally qualified. They just didn't know. And it turns out she got that role.
Interesting. The way I look at it is I think, first of all, be strategic. Sit back and say, are you fully aware of what it's going to take to take on this next promotional role? So you're arguing that you should be VP of something, some category, whatever. Do you understand what that role is? Because they're going to ask you, do you understand that you're going to have to do X, Y, and Z? Are you capable? Please show us some proof that you can pull it off and back and forth. A lot of times women lead with emotion, and they do. Men, I think, less so, unless they're just in an angry testosterone day. But women, I think, sometimes just like, am I dressed perfectly? Am I going to be okay? Do they like me? I'm like, screw this. It's like, what they want is the bottom line here.
Yeah.
Can you pull it off? They don't care if you have 14 ears. What they want to know is, do you have the skill set to pull this off? Are you smart enough and articulate enough to be able to share that with that individual you're having the conversation? Be prepared for everything. Don't just sit there and be surprised. Like, what? He asked me if I could actually do the job.
Right.
What?
So I had a fun example of this. I was being interviewed. And my daughter happened to be in this discussion. She was listening in on this discussion. And the person I was talking to was looking for someone to work with a CEO who was fairly new in the job. And they had all kinds of corporate problems. The company wasn't in good shape and there were a lot of politics, blah, 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 blah. And the interviewer was saying to me, well, do you think that's something that could you construct some kind of program that would help resolve this situation? I said, oh, absolutely. You know, I do that all the time. Here's where I would start. Here's what I do next. Da, da, da. And we end up finishing the call. And my daughter looks at me with like eyes as round as this. And she says, Mom, you answered as though you really could do that. I said, of course I can do that. I've been doing this for years. Like, why would I answer any other way? But it was interesting, her young take on this, which was to see a confident woman absolutely say, yes, I can take on this thorny, gnarly, awful problem, and I can help you sort your way out of it. But with confidence and calmness and just, yeah, that's no, I've seen this one before. You know, I've played this movie many
times.
Never
be afraid of rejection. You know, there's a message in whatever flavor rejection. My niece, who just got her PhD in material science engineering, I didn't even understand what the hell she said in her dissertation, which says something since I'm a scientist too. Oh my goodness gracious. Anyway, so her goal is to become an astronaut. And if you listened to the live stream with the two astronauts who just came down from that horrible 9 months up there, Butch was one of them and Sonny was the other. So Butch, he's just sitting back and he's saying, never really considered the astronaut thing, but then I don't know, I started like doing a little bit of flying here, some schooling there, kind of look cool. Think I want to do it. So he went ahead and applied, didn't make it. It was just a nice little, hey, thanks for trying. Didn't make it. And I looked at his face and this is exactly what he said, because I sent this whole video over to my niece. He said, yeah, same time with the next and the next application. He said, finally, I just ground them down and they couldn't stand it anymore. And I love that. It's like, bring it on. I'm going to grow some hair on my chest over this whole thing. And so I explained that to her because, believe it or not, as young as she was and just barely getting her PhD, she had already made it about 80% into the program. And at the very end, it was like, you know, I think she was maybe a little too young. Who the hell knows? But she said, oh, I didn't make it. And I said, oh, well, have I got a live stream for you? And then we found out that the average number of applications to become an astronaut before you're accepted is between 7 and 12. So anybody who thinks it's just like a slam dunk, like, oh, they love me, you know, I'm a good flyer and I'm an engineer or whatever the hell you are in STEM for that thing. I just fell off my chair when I saw that statistic. It made her feel really good. She goes, well, one down. And that's one of the reasons why I love that. It builds resilience in you. And I think that that's so important. Well, you know something, Rita, I love this. I learned so much. I guarantee you that the Herb Podcast audience was out there taking notes furiously, just furiously. I love your work. Kudos to you for the brilliance in your work and helping us all understand this whole issue about pivoting, just being able to pivot, understanding ourselves when we do decision making, and then being aware of those inflection points and what they really mean in your life. I absolutely love this. And again, the book is Seeing Around Corners. Seeing Around Corners, how to spot inflection points in business before they happen. Even though it's a business book, a lot of us are in business. We still have monkey business too in our personal lives. And I think we made some pretty good analogies here. Wouldn't you think, Rita?
Indeed. Well, there is a chapter in the book on your personal, on how you think about this personally. So there's some insight there. Yeah. Okay. So I have to tell you a little backstory about the book. Okay. So I thought one of the big inflection points in business that was worth talking about was how many women are now, you know, at an age where, and at a career stage where they're much more senior. So I dedicated a chapter to specifically how women lead. You know, what are some of the differences in how women lead than men lead? And my editor, who was this crusty, very traditional New York type editor, he reads this chapter and he comes back to me, says, Rita, I just don't think this chapter is of general interest. I'm not making this up.
Are you kidding me?
I'm not kidding you.
And what was your reply?
I didn't know what to say. I was speechless. I was just, you're telling me half the population and it's not generally.
Yeah, like 51% of the population. Hello?
Well, and like every other leadership book we've ever read has been about men, and this is the one that's not of general interest. Anyway, it did end up editing it and modifying it to be a little broader, but I did keep the examples of the women in, and I did,
well,
did
good
keep
for
the examples
you.
Of women's leadership. You know, but isn't that hilarious?
Keep us as a sliver, a little sliver in there, you know, as we're out here becoming more abrasive every day with everything that we do. Rita, thank you so much for being on the HERP podcast.
It's been a pleasure. I'm so delighted you invited me.
And everyone out there, we've been talking to Dr. Rita McGrath, who's the best-selling author and professor at Columbia Business School. And boy, we learned a lot. And I also want to thank my sponsor, Solaray, vitamins, minerals, and herbs rooted in nature in the new Her Life Stages products. Scope it out at solaray.com. And hey, take a minute to leave us a review because we love to hear from you. It's all about that. This is a production of Podcast Health. And remember something so important. I love to end my show with this, that your time in this world may be limited, but the things you could do at that time are not. So get on out there. Come on now. Carpe diem. Seize the day. Everyone, thanks.